tell me where in the world is
crime in San Diego? Welcome back to another episode of Where in the World is Crime in San Diego? We are back to our regularly scheduled program. Thank you, everyone, who has listened to our Maya updates. Thank you, Angie, for all of your hard work and dedication for these last, 10 preliminary hearing days that we had that was spread throughout, almost 3 weeks?
2 weeks, I want to say.
2.5 weeks, right?
You call it work, I call it fun, but it was definitely labor for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean,
if you haven't tuned in and you want to binge, there's an entire, basically the main case and then the preliminary throughout. So if you haven't listened in, go catch up. It's so much detail. Can't even begin.
Yeah, like we literally could not fit all these details in one episode, even if you tried. And you listen to that and you will be up to date, up to speed on what we all know. So, and with come September, we're going to be having the same situation with the trial. So get ready for that. Buckle down, hunker down, get ready for that, because we're also waiting for that. And I agree with you where we have like this little bit of like a letdown, like, okay, now that we're doing with that, what do we do with our lives?
Yeah, that was my first question. I'm like, now what do I dedicate myself to? But don't worry, we found another case to keep us busy right after.
Oh, definitely. There's not a shortage of cases for us to discuss and share with you guys here that have happened locally in our own county.
And considering that we're approaching Valentine's Day, we are starting off with some of that tale as old as time romance. The spouse did it. The question in this story is not the who, but the why and the what. And it will all make sense in about 30-ish minutes. So stick with us.
This one has my head wrapping around too. And I'm just like, oh, wow, so many things to look into. And it reminds you of, you know, kind of the opposite situation with Maya.
That was the biggest, like, odd part about it.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's completely different circumstances, but
it's almost like Maya was in a toxic relationship. That's not up for debate, but she was trying to, like, she almost took too long to get out. And this person claims to have been in a toxic relationship, and we'll kind of get more into details, but they went too aggressive at trying to get out and ended up on the wrong side of the law.
That's exactly what happened, you know.
It's like there's no in between of like how much force is the correct amount of force.
Exactly, and that's true. And who are we going to talk about? Well, I'm glad that you asked. Today's episode is called Jailhouse Julie.
Disclaimers for this week include domestic violence, gun violence, and murder. Sources are NBC, ABC, Oxygen.com, Times of San Diego, LA Times, The True Crime Daily, Law and Crime, Dateline, Secrets Uncovered, Cinemaholic, and San Diego Reader. And we might have missed one or two because there was a lot, but those are our primary sources. Okay, we're going to start by introducing Jason Harper. He grew up as a very tall, and I mean very tall, 6'6", 6'7". So more than average, but he also had a natural love of sports, which totally made sense. And he kind of stood out to the point where it made him a little different or awkward. He was very social with friends, but he just didn't know how to talk to girls. Even throughout high school, like, he just focused on sports and school. Eventually, he went to UCLA. He focused on his studies. And it wasn't until right after he graduated that he went to, like, he started going out to college parties and, like, meeting girls, and even still felt very awkward to approach. But one night he went out to a college party with some buddies, and he noticed a girl looking at him. And, like, it wasn't like the looking at him like he's freakishly tall, but it was like the googly eyes kind of thing.
this is the, oh, I'm checking you out. I'm seeing what you got.
Yeah. Like, she describes it as, like, looking him up and down, which, if he's 6'7", I'm sure was, like, very obvious.
It was a lot of, like, the head literally had to go up and down.
That night, Jason met Julie. And after a couple of flirty exchanges and changing phone numbers, eventually they began to date. And they fell hard. I mean, head over heels. And that's not a hype pun. But they got engaged after just 3 short months of dating.
It's head over heels, just like the band Tears for Fears. Never heard that song?
Wrong audience again. Maybe somebody else listening, but not me.
Anyways, continue.
Andrew. Anyways, Julie was the entire package. She was beautiful, blonde. She came from a really good family. She had studied at Harvard. She was everything he could ask for and more. And they actually got married at the Hotel Del in Coronado, which is not a cheap wedding.
No, it's not. That's a very expensive wedding for sure. You're talking about oceanfront, expensive, you know, well-known hotel, you know, over 100 years old.
Prime tourist location. Yeah, like her family was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right after getting married, they immediately moved to a gated community in Carlsbad. And Jason became a math teacher and a volleyball coach, which he always loved sports. So that was perfect for him. Like, his prime sports were surfing and volleyball. So I think volleyball and, like, mixing it with his students was just, like, a great way to click.
Well, definitely being 6'7", you have that height advantage. So it's like, you think about, you know, volleyball being like the spiker, the defender at being so tall, or even like a basketball player. Those would probably be like the top two sports that I would imagine him being successful at.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously Julie couldn't do much right after they moved in because she got pregnant with their first child. So she chose to be a stay-at-home mom, which worked out for them. And shortly after having their first child, she got pregnant from their second. So she kind of had back-to-back pregnancies. And for a while, like, it was just her and the kids, and Jason worked full-time. And he was loved and known in the community. And she actually ran a, like, mommy toddler group in the neighborhood. So, like, they just had, like, the perfect American dream cookie cutter life. So when the kids were a little bit older, about 7 and 6, Julie got pregnant with her third child in 2011. And after that child, she just seemed to change. She wasn't as involved with the neighborhood. Instead of, like, stopping and chatting with everybody, she would, like, make a quick wave and then, like, hop in her car and run off, like, avoided contact with neighbors, basically. And it just seemed very unlike her. Jason was still reported to be, like, a very hands-on dad. He was always seen with the kids. He was still involved in, like, the neighborhood watch. And, like, they even called him, like, the neighborhood landscaper, because I guess he was known to, like, do his own landscaping and the ones for the neighbors, too. Like, he was just always there to have a helping hand. So his reputation didn't change much. It was mostly just Julie that seemed a little, again, off. This brings us to the morning of August 7th, 2012, which doesn't seem that long ago, but I realize it's 11 years ago.
Heading into almost 11 years ago.
Yeah, I had to do the mental math. I was like, wait. So according to Julie's account, August 7th started just like any other day. She started to kind of wake up. She was still in bed. It was still early. The kids were downstairs watching TV. It's kind of like that in and out stage of sleeping. And that Jason starts to yell at her and starts waking her about a computer. And she still hadn't fully woken up to know what he was talking about. So he got frustrated. The argument escalated. And it just got really out of hand really fast, like 0 to 100. And next thing she knows, he's like coming at her and like trying to pull her shirt off. And she claims that when he got to this level of anger, he used to rape her. And she was afraid of that's where it was going. In her mind, she was already on like defense mode and trying to like just make it stop. And because it had happened before and was beginning frequently, she had gotten to the point where she feared for her life, and she put a gun under her pillow so that if she ever needed to access it quickly, like that was the best way to grab and go. And she claims that she reached under her pillow, grabbed the gun, and just wanted to scare him. Like, she just figured if he sees the gun, he's going to back off and stop and, like, freeze. And she says that next thing she knows, she's shaking and the gun goes off. And he continues to take advancements towards her. And after like a step or two, he just like flops over, which let's remember he's a pretty decent height. So that was going to make an impact, which she describes as a large thud, thump or thud, thump, I think.
I've heard thud and clunk were the words that were
it makes a noise. And she kind of freaks out. She, you know, tries to like realize what's happening. She realized he's not moving. And next thing she knows, the kids are knocking on the door asking what's happening. So she like creaks open the door and she's like, oh, daddy fell on a chair. He's just like taking a nap on the floor because they can probably see past her that he's on the floor. She covered him with blankets. She covered him with like literally debris, like anything she could find to like just hide him, which he's not easy to hide. And at that point, she grabs her what she calls her getaway bag. And she grabs the kids, straps them in the car. This is all happening at 9 a.m. She grabs the kids, gets them in the car. She drives them to like a playhouse to like hang out for a little bit. And then she goes to a coffee shop. So they're going about their day like nothing happened. Like dad's really at home taking a nap. And then she takes them to her sister's house while she figures out what to do or like how to handle this. She's figuring, you know, this will get sorted out in 2 minutes. It was self-defense. And then, you know, we move on with our lives. If only it was that easy. So she takes him to her sister's house and then she drives to her dad's house and she tells him everything that happened. And her dad hires an attorney. Later that night, the attorney calls. He used to be a district attorney, so he had relations with the Carlsbad police. And he calls them to a private line, internal line, and he tells them, you guys should do a welfare check at this address. So the police, considering it's a reliable source, follow through. They go do a welfare check. They walk into an empty house. Everything seems normal. There's a little bit of disarray, but considering there's children in the home, that's not unusual. They make their way upstairs. Still nothing. They open the master bedroom door, and that's where they find Jason's body under a pile of trash and some blankets.
And it's crazy, too, because it's known that the attorney contacted the police through a non-recorded line. So whatever was said in that conversation, it's not held in court. It wasn't recorded. So this is like new to me. I never knew this is something possible that someone can be like calling the police and it's not recorded. It's crazy.
Well, when you're working between agencies, there's different phone numbers. So that makes sense. And you wouldn't need to record every single one of those calls because they're not all urgent. So that makes sense to me.
It's a tricky, sly move. I feel like that. Obviously, he's a defense attorney, so he's kind of and he knows the ins and outs. So that's a good plus for him. But wow.
Well, when they get there, they realize that the house is empty other than Jason's body. And they realize the kids are gone. There's no sign of Julie. So they start having to look at all aspects of this. Is it a home invasion? Is it kidnapping? Like, did they really run away? Like, what happened? And as they start to investigate, by the next morning, the neighbors start to come out and see the house full of tape. And one of the neighbors comes over kind of being a little nosy. And she's like, hey, like, is everything OK? When obviously it's not, because who has like 15 police cars and crime tape all over their house when things are OK?
Mm-hmm.
But the police officer basically tells her, you should go home and turn on the news. So she goes home. She turns on the news and she's literally watching Jason's body get carried out on the gurney. And you can tell because of the size of the body, like that's not rocket science. And they're like carrying him out onto one of the ambulances. And she's just like, you know, like they didn't even let me stand there. And I'm like, well, no, you're not going to stand there and watch it live. But, you know, you get an idea what's happening. And at that point, it just became clear. The attorney that had called in the tip let them know, like, hey, I'm calling on behalf of my new client. So I got retained by Julie. And she wants to come clean. So he facilitates to drop off the kids at a local children's hospital to get checked and inspected and for police to take custody of them and like not make it a big thing. And then he arranges for her to surrender at her dad's house. So when they arrive, obviously everything looks really suspicious because why would you hire an attorney if you didn't do anything wrong? And why didn't you go straight to the police if you needed help? Like, there's a lot of questions, obviously. So they get there and they arrive with a search warrant. And they're like, okay, just as protocol, we're going to search the house. They searched the house. They found firearms, but none of them that belonged to the murder or like the weapon. So they're like, okay, let's leave. A couple of days later, they weren't satisfied and they decided to do another search warrant. And they found a backpack in the attic of her dad's house. And this backpack had a passport, $39,000 in cash, jewelry, Jason's cell phone, and Jason's last will and testament. And this was considered Julie's getaway bag. But the very first search, they checked the attic and it wasn't in there. So somebody had to have gone back and planted it after that search. Which isn't unheard of. People do that all the time. They feel like, okay, I'm in the clear. I can put things back now. But it just like shocks me anyways.
Well, for it to even be in the attic, it just shows that someone went out of their way to put it, that kind of stuff out of sight, out of mind for anyone to find.
Well, to the district attorney handling this case, they felt that that was enough proof that it was premeditated. If you had a backpack with his cell phone and his will in there, like you were planning on needing it after he was gone.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I totally agree with that.
So Julie was charged and arrested with first degree murder, and her bail was set at a whopping $2 million. Remember how I said her family was doing okay?
Yes.
They paid the bail.
And that's crazy because the bail is so 10%. So that's $200,000 just right out the door for her to get out.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. Just insane amount of money.
I don't know if my family loves me enough to pay that price tag, even if they could.
If that happened to you, baby, I wouldn't be able to get you out. I'd be like, sorry, you guys stay in there. I got nothing. And you know, it goes both ways. Like, what do you want me to do? I don't have that kind of cash.
But if you had it, would you pay it?
Yes.
Oh, see, if I had it, I don't know if I'd spend it on that.
Ouch.
You did the crime, you pay the time.
Oh, I see how it is. Okay. So get this. There's a lot of details that came out after her arrest and her bail. So since she made bail, she walked and she stayed. You know, there's these things that happen where you make bail, but you're supposed to stay around the county. So like you get, you know, supervision, whether you get that ankle bracelet and stuff like that, like home arrest, basically, right? Mm-hmm. So things started coming out like 5 days before the actual incident. She went to the bank and she took out $20,000 in cash. She filed for divorce. A year before the actual shooting, Julie has sent a friend like a package. And in that package were journals, some writings, bank statements, a personal log of safekeeping and stuff like that to try, I guess, try to cover her ends, you know?
I think from what I read, it was like over the course of a year, she kept sending evidence technically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To her friend. And it was just more of like, you know, they weren't happy and that their marriage was going towards the divorce.
Wait, side note on the money. The crazy part is she took $10,000 out of her daughter's account. Wasn't even her account, like when you open savings for your kids.
Yes.
And then she took $4,500 from, she cashed herself a check from Jason's credit card to herself twice. And I think she did it because anything under $5,000 doesn't usually get flagged as like a large amount.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think that was like her plan was like, that's an easy way to get $9,000 without like it looking weird.
But on a credit card, though, like, geez,
you can cash checks against a credit card.
Dangerous. And then
where do you keep yours? Just kidding.
We're not married just yet, so we haven't gotten that far.
No, you can still write me a check. I know what your signature looks like.
Oh, yeah. It looks like trash.
It's easy to copy.
So we get back into 2014, and this is where Julie has, get this, it's her first trial. The judge at the time, Blaine Bowman, declared that the first trial is a mistrial. She was, the verdict came out where the first degree murder charge, she was acquitted for. But then there was a bit of confusion because the jury wasn't solely convinced that she was innocent or guilty for the other charges. So that's when the judge decided to have a mistrial. And I looked this up because there was two different charges of involuntary manslaughter and involuntary manslaughter. Now I get really thrown because the, both words are very similar. So right. Voluntary manslaughter is almost like premeditated manslaughter, killing that you had an intention. And involuntary is more of like it's accidental, passion, heat of the moment kind of murder. This is where things take a real good, we like to call it pretzel, twists and turns is what we like to call it. And Angie, take it away.
Okay, so Julie gets out and she tries to resume to life as normal as possible. She goes back to living in the home where she murdered her husband just a year or years prior. She goes back to like taking the kids to school, and like obviously the community didn't welcome her back with open arms. So like it was very strange for her neighbors, and they would watch from a distance but didn't really interact. And she feels that it's just, it's done, it's over. And to her surprise, the district attorney went back and started building a case for her for second degree murder and ready to start over. And he actually sets a trial date for April of 2015. So they're getting ready to go. And 1 month before the trial is set to start, Julie drops a bombshell. She lets them know that she will not be able to attend that trial because she is 7 months pregnant.
What? This is huge.
When I tell you, I screamed when I read this, like, you don't even know.
Like, you know how we have like that deer headlight look, or either like we have our eye, the whites of our eyes. Once we were listening to this, oh my gosh, my jaw dropped.
It was pure silence for like a couple seconds. Like I needed to register that.
Yes.
Even and before you ask, because the first question in my head was like, well, Jason's dead, so who's the dad?
Mm-hmm.
And she claims that it was through IVF and it was an anonymous donor. There were rumors that while she was out, she was seen with another man and that it could have been her ex-boyfriend, which would have led to like a potential murder or like, I mean, motive or like an affair, like to kind of reason why she wanted out of the marriage so quickly. Of course, as soon as the prosecution and the public learns of this, they automatically think it's a stunt. It's a sympathy move so that nobody will want to convict a pregnant mother for murder. Like, I mean, you'd have to be a little heartless to do that.
Yeah, but, you know, like, the judge had a mistrial. So it's like, even though in that moment, like, hey, like, you're going scot-free because you're not convicted, it's going to come back and bite you in the butt. So it was,
well,
it was
all I bound can to say happen. Is that girl worked quick because she wasn't even out for more than a year. Like, she was fast.
Yeah, exactly.
She gave birth in April of 2015 to her fourth daughter. And on the birth certificate, she did not list the father, which just supported that she had no idea who it was. Which I don't think for donors even do that.
Yeah, the whole like in vitro fertilization. Yeah. Yeah.
So at this point, the trial is reset to September because by then she should be good and ready to go. And this second trial brings out everything from the first one and just in a different light, obviously. The DA is a little more prepared. They kind of thought their questions a little more. And you can tell that they did their homework in between that time.
Yeah, going through the research, there was a lot more things that came out. Definitely something that came out this time around was like a letter or information about her sending a note to like another man 17 days after the passing of her husband, Jason. There was that in the court where they showed that. And that was like a little bit of a motive. Like, it was just really strange. Like, why? Like, it gave more motion to like she was already moving on, and it made it suspicious for her, for the court, for her to move on after this. And then also the children testified against her in the court. And obviously, you know, there's videos, there's recordings, and they don't show the, because they're minors, they don't show the video of or their faces.
Yeah, no, of course but not.
All the both kids said that they don't like her. They don't want their, they don't see it as their mom anymore. They're mad that she killed their father.
Her older son had a harder time. Like, he just kind of didn't want to be there, didn't want to talk. At one point, he said, I'd rather be in school. Like, this isn't what I want to be doing with my day. And you can tell, like, I can't even imagine what he feels, because he is a little bit older and might understand the spectrum a little bit more. Her daughter is just kind of to the point where she's like, you know what? Like, I'm convinced you did it. You're a bad person. Like, that's all I need to know. You took my dad away from me. End of story. You're not my mom. Like, I don't need you. So during multiple witness statements, a lot of people came forward to say that they never suspected any form of abuse between the marriage. They never saw any markings on her or bruises, anything that would indicate harm. They took photos of her shortly after she had turned herself in. So she turned herself in 16 hours after the crime. That's when she set up her surrender. And when they took photos, there was no marks of like defensive wounds or, you know, healing bruises, anything that indicated abuse, at least physical abuse. The district attorney also questioned her about a journal that she kept. And in her journal, she uses the word sex quite often. And she says that sex was code for rape because she was just afraid if he found it, or like, it just, she didn't want it to come off weird. So she would use that word. And that was her code word, like, for herself. And she would document every incident that would happen. But what was odd in that same entry or in that same diary, there was other entries where it said that she wanted more foreplay and she wanted to spice up their sex life. And she wanted to, like, work on it. Which, devil's advocate, could mean that she was just trying to hint at him that she wanted, like, that to stop happening and, like, to actually, like, it become consensual. But at the same time, I realize where the wording's very confusing. But she does own both statements. She says, yes, I wrote both of those entries. I felt different at different times. Sometimes I would want that relationship with my husband, and sometimes I didn't want him to touch me. Like, it just depended. Next question that the district attorney asked or tackled was, like, why not report it? If it was ongoing for 30 plus times throughout your marriage, why not just say something? And she said that she was too embarrassed for her friends and family to find out what was happening. She knows that Jason was well loved and cared for in the community, and she didn't know if anybody would actually, like, believe her. And other than taking a couple videos of him yelling at her and her writing and documenting these instances, like, she had no actual proof. She also references that there had been a prior case of Ray Rice, a football player who, because of his status, nobody believed him or believed his partner that she was being a victim of domestic abuse. So she kind of applied that same mentality to her. And more than anything, she knew that if she reported Jason and he lost his job, it would affect their livelihood and it would ultimately affect her children. So she just felt like it wasn't appropriate way to handle things. The next thing they attacked was they had her replay the entire incident during the first trial. And they told her to reenact every moment of what she remembered in front of everybody. And it was very traumatizing. It was very emotional. She obviously had a couple breakdowns throughout. And how could you not? That is a very traumatizing moment. But it was so emotionally charged that the DA felt that the jury wasn't looking at it clearly. Like, they were just caught up in the dramatics of it. So this time around, he kind of revisited without having her reenact the same thing, because that proved to not work. He kind of had her walk them through it. So just using sentences, explain to us a story, point A to point B. And he explains how her story of him coming to her doesn't add up with the trajectory that they made on a computer from what the medical examiner found the angle of the bullet was. The bullets were still in his chest when they found him. So it was very easy to try to trace how they entered his body, which is kind of a good thing that it made their job a little less of a guessing game.
Yeah, it's always interesting how forensic science and the technologies that they use to try to solve these cases or actually present the evidence in the courtroom. It's pretty amazing how they're able to do this stuff.
And this was back in 2012. So, I mean, I'm sure it's advanced a pretty decent amount since then.
Well, yeah, 2012, 2015, like in 3 years. Like this.
Oh, that's right.
This was in 2015. So a lot has happened. And even since then, now looking at it from 11 years now, a lot of things have changed with technology on it for sure. Yeah.
Well, in order to prove his point, because he was not about to let this case get away from him a second time, he had the jury dry fire the exact same gun so that he could prove that it's not an easy trigger to like have go off. It's not one of those where you can like light tap and it just goes off on its own. It's a small handheld and it's really difficult. Like you have to put force into the trigger.
Yes. It's like a revolver style kind of type of gun where literally you do have to pull back on the trigger and it's not easy like an actual like hand, like millimeter, like Glock or anything like that. It's really like you have to, like you said, force it.
Yeah. So that kind of nailed that and was a nail in a coffin where like, hey, like that's not, that story doesn't add up of like, oops, I was looking and then all of a sudden it just like accidentally went off.
Yeah.
And then he also asks, like, he addresses the fact that it's never been recovered. She claims that she had buried it in her dad's house for, like, safekeeping. Which, again, if you didn't do anything wrong, why would you hide a murder weapon? But even if you hid it, you would at least know where you put it and, like, be willing to turn it in. I mean, we already know what you did. It's just, what did you do it with? And it's never been recovered. And she says that for the life of her, she cannot remember where she buried it. She knows she buried it. She just doesn't remember where she buried it.
I don't believe that.
Which the inconsistency in the stories from trial one to trial two do begin to add up.
Yeah, those are not helping her case this time around.
The biggest question, though, is why cover him in blankets and trash? What are you planning to accomplish with that? And why wait 16 hours to turn yourself in? Why not call 911 and see if they can do life-saving measures? Like, it's different if you call and you say, hey, I shot someone and they might be dead. Like, can you come and check and, like, take over? But for her to just take her kids out, go around town, take them to her sister's, and then be like, oh, I should probably handle this, like, it's very odd.
She completely act like nothing happened. And, you know, and it's just like, her kids were, I mean, they're so young, they don't know what's
going on. They were old enough to know when something sounds off, though.
Yeah. But it's like, in that moment, it's like, okay, we're going to listen to you, Mom. Let's go have fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, she always has an answer. Like, she's very quick with her answers. And she says, well, my biggest fear was for my kids to have to see him like that. Like, I didn't know how to tell them, or I didn't even know what had just happened. And the last thing I wanted was for them to have this visual of their dad. So I needed to get them out of the house, which kind of makes sense. It's not saying it's right, but I devil's advocate. I'm like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, you're trying to protect the you know, the, what's that called? I guess you wanted to, the innocence of the children seeing their dad decease. But it's still the steps that were taken, they were completely wrong.
But then how do you explain grabbing your getaway bag? If you're in this state of trauma where you need to get out of the house and grab and go, the getaway bag is on your priority list?
And that's where, to me, this is more like premeditation.
Well, she states that all abused women, when in an abusive relationship, are advised to have a getaway bag in case it comes to a point where you cannot be in that home anymore. You need to be able to have a form of, like, getting out of the situation. So that's something that she had been advised as being an abused woman. So she was just doing it as like a protection thing.
I can see that.
But then wouldn't you have the passports for your children if you're planning on taking your kids with you?
True. I mean, I don't think she was thinking of it ahead where she was trying to get away for herself and then also like leave the kids behind because she was going to take the kids with her. But I didn't think she didn't think that through all the way with taking the kids, like identifications or passports with her as well.
Well, the way he was shot was like from the back, like the rib cage. And we'll obviously show photos of the the direction of the bullet. But that was, I think, some of the biggest questions were like, no answer she gave would have made sense.
Yeah, because she mentioned that Jason was approaching her through the front, but when the evidence was showing more that it was like Jason was actually probably walking away, and yeah. she just was like angry and in the heat of the moment and shot him. That's what I would feel like happened.
They also did bring out a video of, it's not the best light of Jason. So she's sitting, I think she's like probably sitting on the floor. It's like a lower angle. And he's standing up holding the smallest child. And he's yelling at her about having a low credit score. And he's calling her names. And he's saying how like he's embarrassed by her and how he's not going to put up with it because of her poor choices. And it just like he mentions about like divorce attorneys and how he's not willing to pay, you know, thousands of dollars for divorce attorneys. And he doesn't look, I mean, he definitely looks angry and a little aggressive. I don't know if he looks like he's about to physically attack her, but he definitely is like talking with his hands and very agitated.
Yeah. And I think a lot of arguments get like that, honestly. But I feel like
it did look unhealthy.
In the video, it did not look good for Jason.
It didn't warrant murder, but it didn't look, I mean, I can see devil's advocate that escalating to another level mm-hmm. by the way his anger was increasing.
Yeah, definitely for sure with that.
But either way, at the end of this trial, the jury made a unanimous decision that she was guilty of second degree murder. What made this case different was right after that ruling, or right around the time of that, a new law came out in the state of California that allowed the judge to reduce 25 years off the sentence if they chose to for any charge of having a gun involved in the crime. So basically, the way they kind of broke it down was it would have been 25 years for using a gun for murder and then 15 years for second degree murder, which equaled 40 years. And after the defense attorneys made their case, they gave one chance for the family to make a victim impact statement, which is when the victims or remaining survivors of the person can come forward and plead to the judge before he makes his final ruling. During this, the kids came up and said their piece. Jackie wrote, "You left me and my brother as orphans. You caused us and my grandparents so much pain. You are no longer mom, just Julie." Her son wrote, "She deserves to serve all 40 years." And of course, Jason's mom also came up saying, you know, she should do the full time. This is unforgivable. He didn't deserve that. And the judge ultimately agreed with Jake, her son, and he sentenced the full 40 years. She tried to appeal it, seeing if the new law applied, and he denied it again.
It's like, stay. You're not going anywhere.
So as of now, she will be eligible for parole in 2039. She was in Las Colinas in Santee for a little bit, and now she's up in Chino at a women's correction facility. She has not shied away from the camera. She's done quite a few interviews since her sentencing, and she did address a couple of things. The biggest question was, like, why get pregnant if you knew you were potentially looking at 40 years? Because that's what the first trial was set for. And she says it's because she knew she had lost her kids. Like, they were never going to want anything to do with her. And she honestly believed that the system was going to take her side. And she claims that even though you can't see her physical abuse, like, her mental and emotional abuse is very alive in her. She also addresses the whole ex-boyfriend allegation. And she says that she knows what man they're referring to, but that they are just very good friends, that she stayed faithful during and to the end of her marriage. She does claim that she never did anything wrong. She shot in self-defense, and she knows, and God knows, that she didn't do this and she was wrongfully convicted. And, you know, she hopes that her kids one day will understand. But it hurts her that, like, her kids see her in that light and that their lives have changed so much.
Well, I agree with the kids. There's no going back on this. She's going to have to eat the bullet with it, literally, because
Nice pun.
She deserves every year on that sentencing for this crime.
So she did say that her family and friends are hurting alongside her for this wrongful conviction. And her fourth daughter is in custody of the father. And she is fighting and appealing for parental rights, which I don't understand why, if you're not going to be out for at least another 20 years.
Yeah.
Ish.
And it's crazy because, you know, it has the similarities to Jay Jenks, where, you know, the circumstantial evidence of where, you know, Thomas Merriman was, you know, pedophile, having nude photos, but she took it too far. And that falls here too, where, yeah, maybe there was domestic violence, there was domestic abuse, but taking it to this point where a gun was involved and murder, it took it too far.
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, like, couldn't he shot like his foot or his leg, or like not shot him at all? I don't know.
Or couldn't she have just thrown like, say, like a coffee pot or like a coffee cup, something at him to just, you know, not be so dramatic with the gun?
Well, like her lawyer did point out that at that point, like she had a history of suffering with rheumatoid arthritis. And it seemed that Jason didn't really believe that was a real illness. So he would like make fun of her for it. The medication she was on caused some weight gain, which he would like bully her for almost. And he would make comments about like how she was gaining weight and how she wasn't taking care of herself and how she was always in pain or always hurting. So at one point they made a claim that she was abusing her prescription drugs to like try to get through, which reminded me of Tough Pill to Swallow, our previous episode of like, yeah, those prescription drugs can kind of take over you a little bit. So that was another argument that the district attorney had, is like, well, if she's heavily intoxicated on medications, she wasn't thinking clear with a clear head, but she's still responsible for the actions that she did during that time. So I think it was just a buildup of a lot of different things. But I do feel that it went obviously way too far. Jason seems like he was very loved in the community by both his coworkers, his neighbors, his students. He really made an impact.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, you know, definitely for sure, because, you know, Carlsbad High School, it's not too far from the high school that I went to, you know, back in my alumni days. And it's just very unfortunate. And, you know, it's sad to see someone like that go away too soon.
So like I mentioned earlier in the episode, the biggest question isn't who or what, but why, and did she do it? And let us know what you guys think. I'm torn. Like, part of me wants to think that she really was trying to defend herself, but so much of it says that it's just, I think the getting pregnant after really pushed me in the manipulative, planning, con artist-y kind of mindset.
I think she played the victim card.
Yeah.
I do feel that there was some kind of abuse there, and that I think if she would have gotten a divorce, it would have been okay, that's it. But she took it too far.
Well, here's the thing. His parents like knew that there was problems in the marriage. Her family knew there was problems in the marriage. They were already expecting a divorce to come down the pipeline, to the point where his parents bought a house in their neighborhood with enough bedrooms for Jason and the kids to move into. So they were kind of already telling him, like, hey, if you need to leave her, you bring the kids here and leave her the house. And, like, let her, you know, do whatever she needs to do. You guys come here. His mom had already been checking on him because she was worried for his safety. Just because she knew that, one, she was on prescription pills and they had a toxic relationship. So nobody was really shocked when they found out what happened. It was just like the why, which is where we're at. Like, why would you go this far?
Totally. So let us know what you guys think. Message us on our comments, DM us on our Instagram and Facebook, and let us know what you guys think. So now we've reached the end of our episode, and we have our SBS of the week.
Small Business Spotlight.
Angie, take it away.
All right. So this is a really good friend of mine. I am super proud of her. She just hit 1 year with her business. And that's literally where we're all about here, is supporting small businesses. So for all the ladies listening, or for gentlemen, if you want to treat your girl to like eyebrow lamination or just like really nice eyebrows for Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day is coming up, guys.
That's exactly where my head was at. Make sure to check out. I have her Instagram because I believe that's all she's really using right now to set up appointments. SavageBeauty.lounge. Sorry. So yeah, SavageBeauty.lounge. I will be sharing her Instagram and her reels so you guys can see her work. She's amazing. She's the sweetest. She is a hustler, a mama, a business owner. She's awesome. You will not regret it. So go check her out. I've gone to her multiple times and I feel like a Barbie when I come out.
I can vouch for that because your eyebrows look amazing once you come back from her.
And my attitude changes.
Which is a plus for me. So
I come back with those baddie vibes.
For sure. Please go check them out. Let us know when you guys go visit her. Let us know what you guys think.
Yes. If you visit her and you post on Instagram, tag us and her page just so we can see that you went. And yeah, make sure to stay tuned for your next episode of Where in the World is Crime in San Diego? Till then, catch us on the next case.
And in case we don't see you, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Tell me, where in the world is
Crime in San Diego?